The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salner and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salner, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition, even though we're going to be answering questions today. As we promised from our recent, what turned out to be a five-part series, we're big on those, apparently, talking about our asset management, our philosophy, how we do it, why we do it the way we do it, and then ultimately what we charge to do it for people who come to us for asset management services. We've had a bunch of questions come in related to that series, so we thought it'd be helpful to kind of wrap things up, if you will, by answering those questions. We might get through all the questions today on this show. If not, we might actually extend this for a second week into the next EDU show, but we will get all your questions answered because there's a lot of great questions coming in. Actually, I've seen a handful of them so far. Jim has the whole pile. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to answer your questions and maybe add a little more clarity than we gave you in that full five-part series that we just wrapped up last week.
So, yes, because five parts weren't enough, so we need more
clarity.
Five parts
wasn't quite enough, so I think this is a result of our unscripted fly-by-to-your-seat-of-your-pants kind of approach to the podcast. I mean, if you had a clear outline with everything laid out, we probably would have touched on every little element, but we don't roll that way.
Well, we could have done it in less than five shows.
Knowing we could answer a bunch of questions then afterwards. Yeah. Well, we could do both of those things. Both of those would be a benefit, but that's apparently not our style. So
we have never scripted this show since day one, way back when we were a radio show, going live on a Saturday morning.
Yeah, that's
we went
very
in with
clear.
No script.
To anyone who's listened for more than 8 minutes, they know exactly that is true.
And that's one reason, listener, we carried literally, we're a live radio show out of Greeley, Colorado, and we never did. We would go in and have, I'd pick you up at that, mm-hmm. It's so built up now where I used to pick you up, but I can't remember the name of the, what is that? It's I-25 and 34, right? Johnstown? Uh-huh. I think it was in Johnstown.
That is Johnstown right there, yeah. That's
Johnstown.
In the Sentara era.
And I would pick Chris up, mm-hmm. and you would think for the next 20 minutes we would talk about what do we want to do on the show? No, we'd talk about other things. And literally we get in there and, okay, let's talk about Roths today. So it was totally unscripted live show, and it worked, and we carried that over, and we just never scripted anything. So anyways, it works for me because I wouldn't be able to read from a script. It just I remember we had a compliance team at the time, folks, and so we had to get their permission to do a radio show.
Yep.
So they said, okay, well, you can do the radio show. Just give us the script beforehand so we can approve it. And I remember saying to them, script?
Yeah.
What script?
not like an old-time radio show, like it's acting.
And they went on to say they wanted what I was going to say before I would say it so they could make sure what I was saying was okay to say. And it took me forever to get them to understand. If I can't tell you, and at the time it was only 30 minutes. Me trying to do a 30-minute show, folks, with commercials. It gave us, what, about 23 minutes to talk? And I was like, if I can't talk for a half hour on what I do for a living, I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing. And I finally got them to agree to it, but we had to send them the recording immediately after doing the live show. The radio station would record it for us, and we would have to send it to them to listen to it and make sure I didn't say anything wrong. Just weirdest thing.
Yeah.
Alrighty, anyways, let's get into this because we have questions about the whole podcast series that we did on our investment management philosophy, process, approach, whatever you want to call it, and for the first time ever discussing fee structure. The reason we wanted to do all this, we know most of you are do-it-yourselfers, but we do know eventually some, maybe all of you at some point in time, believe it or not, will want to either hire someone to help them or start directly managing the assets yourself if you already aren't. You may have assets in a 401k and they're kind of handling it for you and you're thinking, well, when I retire, I'm going to move it to an IRA to me. So we wanted, me meaning you, not me personally, my firm. What I wanted to accomplish on this five-part series was to just try to explain to you why I went from believing in active management as an active manager using active management investments, how I went from that upbringing, which Chris was really drilled into my head at Boston University in 1995 when I was studying financial planning because it was the middle of the 90s bull market, Chris. It's, yeah. Of course you're going to do equities. Of course you're going to do stocks. And it was just your active and passive, except for a Vanguard, which was always considered this feisty little thing off to the side. Everything was active managed. So that was drilled into my head, and I wanted to lay out the whole experience that I went through to go from an active manager using active investments to a passive approach utilizing the mimicking of benchmarks, if you will, a passive manager using passive investments. And then we wanted to go a step further and say, here's how we price. Because it's a big thorn in our side in our industry. We don't believe, just like we don't believe in Monte Carlo projections for a retirement plan, we don't believe in an uncapped, unlimited AUM structure, asset under management structure, for managing assets. We want it to be far more transparent in our pricing. So from day one, way back in my Waddell & Reed days, I always charge separate for financial planning than I did for asset management, and that continues today. So we wanted to just give you a little bit of insight into how we price. We're not saying our approach is best, and we're not saying our approach works in everything. And the first email I'm going to review, it's not the first email we got, but the first email I'm going to review, Chris, is from an industry person, another planner, who points out something that he's 100% correct on. And he wanted to know, how would we handle something like that? Because the obvious part, especially if you are not a do-it-yourself investor, but if you're a planner who happens to listen to us, you might be picking up, I've been screaming at the podcast, how the hell can you do that if you're trying to do these more advanced types of planning for a client? Our approach isn't for everyone. If you're Tom Brady, oh, the idiot's coming out of retirement. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Is it someone sent me a funny meme or whatever you call those things, you know, the
meme, yeah.
Picture thingies.
Mm-hmm.
It was cute. It was a picture of a gazelle and she's
Giselle.
Huh?
Giselle.
His wife.
Yeah.
Oh, not gazelle. Gazelle is the antelope.
Yeah.
No, oh God, don't tell Tom I called his wife an antelope. Giselle, as right. You said. It's funny. It's a picture of Giselle saying, Tom, now that you're retired, can you pick up the kids and can you stop at the store and can you do this? And it shows a picture of Tom Brady with this befuddled look on his face.
Yeah.
And then the next one, I can't remember it offhand, but I think the next one he's on his phone is like, yeah, I'm coming back. It's kind of cute. But where the hell was I going with that? Oh, Tom Brady. If you have the money of Tom Brady, you're not going to use an advisory firm like ours. Our advisory firm is not designed for that. It's not designed for the ultra high net worth individuals who have tens upon tens of millions, if not in case of the Bradys, hundreds upon hundreds of millions. What we do doesn't suit that. What we do to this listener who is an advisor from Alabama, what we do, and I'll read his email in a second, does directly correlate to the type of clients we pretty much work with. Those generally with investable assets, somewhere in the $2 to $5 million range, total net, I'd say somewhere in the range of, $1 to $5 million range on investable assets, total net worth, generally around $2 to $7 is our typical client, do you think, Chris, or am I off on that? Or you do most of the planning, not me.
That's the right range, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's designed for those people. He points out this, and we are going to, I'll read it, but we want to make clear to the listeners and to other advisors, we have nothing against active management. We have nothing against AUM billing and people charging for it. We don't like it, and we share why, but in certain cases, active management makes sense. And this is what this gentleman wrote to us. He says, "Hi, Jim and Chris. I have been in the advisory, I am in the advisory business and listen to your podcast. I have been intrigued by your latest series talking about your asset managed approach and your fee structure. The thought running through my mind, though, as you guys described your pricing is, he's getting
is
to
this the, that unscripted part we're talking
this
about?
This is a total unscripted part. You know, I print them, listeners. That's printed. I put the wrong email on top. I wanted the next one.
Okay.
This is another guy. We got two from the industry. This guy and another one. You want me to? No, forget it. I'll go back to the one I wanted to do. Now you can tell it's unscripted because we ain't cutting any of this out. This begins, "Hi, Jim, Chris." Oh, and Bob. Threw in a Bob one. "I have been a financial planner and advisor for about as long as Jim." Oh, so he's a nice young fella too. "And I really appreciate the info you guys put out. Even though I think I have learned most of what you talk about, it is really nice to keep sharp by trying to figure out your questions and answers before I hear your answers. On your latest series where you describe your capped fee model for asset management, I wanted to point out that I think it is likely only going to work in your passive approach to portfolio management. In my practice, I manage assets for many clients who have very complex equity positions. And at times, we have to employ unique hedging strategies and techniques for risk management. I know how much work this is, and I can't imagine how you would be able to do it at the prices you mentioned. Can you expand on what you would do with clients in that situation?" What he's getting at, and he is not the one from Bama. The first guy is from Alabama. The one that I didn't read. Well, started to read but didn't finish. What he's getting at, Chris, is what I was trying to encapsulate here. Our approach, and I think you would agree, on asset management is not for everyone. And if we had a client in that situation, if we identified a concentrated stock portfolio, perhaps, as this gentleman is talking about, you can't manage that, Chris, passively. You have to employ active option strategies and start trying to reduce the risk of a concentrated stock portfolio, especially if the person wants to hold it. If you have one and you're willing to sell it, that's how we would mitigate that risk.
And that's, people might be saying, well, why don't they do that? Well, it's not in a retirement account. The one beautiful thing about being in a retirement account is you can rebalance and shift around and do these things without triggering any events. It isn't until money comes out of the account, there's a taxable event. Well, if you have a regular brokerage account, which a lot of people do, you've got to worry about gains being recognized and causing you big tax nightmares. So you can't just suddenly liquidate all of something in order to rebalance and reduce some risks that you might be concerned about. So there's other strategies that we actually have not talked about on the show before. That's not our forte. That's not what we do. No, they exist and recognize them when we see them. But those things are something to consider when you have an account that might have that kind of structure to it.
And to answer his question, what would we do? We don't need to manage all assets. We make that perfectly clear. And we try to, throughout the history of this podcast and the radio show back in Greeley that we were just talking about, we always pointed out to people, you do not have to move your assets to us in order to utilize our retirement planning services. So if our retirement planning philosophy resonates with you, if you want the retirement plan, the tax preparation, the tax planning, the aging assistance, all that stuff, if you will, that comprises our secure retirement income process, we can do that. If we had portfolios and people are moving money over to us, it's the same thing. We would look at the portfolio. If there is a concentrated stock position, we would key in on it. Even if the money is in an IRA and we could get the client out of them without tax implications, we would still talk to the client. We don't just willy-nilly say, you've got to come over to us with everything and we're going to sell it and put it in the way we manage assets. We would say to the client and talk with the client, do you want to hold this? Maybe they do. We have several clients, and I won't name the companies that they work for, but several clients who are probably podcast listeners. They have very concentrated stock portfolios, Chris, but they love the company they used to work for and they don't want to sell those assets. Those people could go to an advisor like this gentleman who wrote to us, and we would encourage them to, because we would freely admit our passive model management approach benchmarked to the Morningstar target risk portfolios is not designed to mitigate a concentrated stock portfolio, mitigate the risk of a concentrated stock portfolio. Let's take those assets and move it to an advisory firm that is one that specializes in that type of need. And that's what we would do. And it's the brilliance, in my opinion, of the capped fee structure. Remember what I said to the, and I'm talking to this listener who's an advisor, but all listeners out there. The reason I wanted to cap it is, yes, I do feel the AUM model, the uncapped AUM model, is a conflict of interest. You are conflicted on both ways, Chris. You're conflicted in money coming in. You want more because the conflict is you're going to get more. But you are also conflicted on the way out. You could lose money if money comes out. I wanted to alleviate both those conflicts, or mitigate them. You can never alleviate them, but mitigate them. So if we are at a capped fee and a client is at that capped fee schedule, and again, I'm just making these numbers up, Chris. Let's say they have $2.5 million and we're managing it, but $1 million of it is in a concentrated stock of Microsoft. Again, just making that company up out of the blue. Our pay doesn't go down if we tell them, take that $1 million. Hey, I know of an advisor in Alabama. Not, I keep putting this guy in Alabama. I know an advisor, and he didn't say where he's from, actually. We got one from Alabama. I don't know where this other guy's from. And we can send them there, and the assets can leave, and it doesn't lower our income, if you will. So it helps alleviate the conflict, Chris, in my opinion, of saying, well, what we're going to have to do is sell some of that, or you know, take the lumps when they come or whatever. No, it doesn't affect my pay, and that's why I wanted to do it. So listener who manages concentrated stock portfolios, that's what we would do. We freely admit our approach is not designed for that. Our approach is for helping people in the distribution phase of retirement spend their money and position it and everything that we reviewed. I know you were about to say something.
Yeah, just that I think that one downside to the traditional way of paying is everyone pays as if they have these issues under a traditional AUM model. We're saying, hey, if you don't have these issues and we can manage it under this very straightforward passive approach and you're comfortable with that, look what we can do with your fees. We can keep them capped very low compared to what is traditional for asset management. It's beautiful. If you don't happen to fit into that mold, that's okay. That doesn't mean you can't participate at all in what we do. It just means that the piece is off to the side. But if you go to a regular asset manager, for the most part, they've got a structure where everybody pays, you know, not based on complexity so much. Some do, but most don't. Most, it's based on how many assets you have with them. Just because you have a big boatload, if you have a simple portfolio, or maybe all of your assets are in retirement accounts, you don't have any of these issues. You can rebalance at will without any type of consequences. they're still charging you, but, you know, kind of like the same way that they're charging the person that has that weird, complex, concentrated stock position that they've got to risk manage with hedging strategies. So, you know, I know not everyone is like that. I'm talking about what's typical or average out there, but it's just another indication of why, if you don't need that, why would you be in a model where you're paying effectively for that?
So what I would want to share for those of you listening to this who are thinking of hiring an advisor, I think this is all a very good question to ask them. Do you need all my assets for me to work with you? What is the approach? What is the investment approach you're going to do? I don't know what they're going to do. You're going to have to ask them. What is your philosophy? You're an active advisor. Are a passive advisor? Do you use active investments or passive investments? And make sure they delineate the two. As that listener said during the whole five-part series we did, Chris, I wasn't adequately delineating when was I talking about being an active advisor and when was I talking about doing, passive advisor and when was I talking about using passive investments. Those two are separate. If you're interviewing an advisor, find out, are they going to be an active or passive advisor? Are they going to use active or passive investments? But also ask them, if I want to invest in asset classes or strategies that you don't specialize in, do I have to have all my money with you? What would you do in that situation? Ask them that. I haven't met any clients. When I used to read that FPA form a lot, there were advisors who posted, they will not work with a client unless they get all assets. I used to read them and think to myself, as an advisor, I would just think to myself, Chris, how the hell can you do that? First of all, how are you going to police it? And then what right do you have to say to your client, I need all or nothing? But there are some people out there like that listener. So that's probably a question you want to ask. In respect to the listener, the advisor who asked, we don't do concentrated stock portfolios and we would refer that out. We do not have to manage all assets and our pricing structure was designed for that, to mitigate as much as possible any conflict of interest with assets coming in, as well as a conflict of interest of us being sticky, if you will, with assets going out. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on. Since I started that other advisor's email from Alabama, I don't want to go to something else. He's probably sitting there saying, well, wait a minute, you read half my damn email. Can you finish it? So let's jump to that one.
Okay.
Hi, Jim and Chris. I am in the advising business and happen to listen to your podcast. I've been intrigued by your latest series talking about your asset management approach and fees. The thought running through my mind as you guys described your pricing was, how do you stay in business in the long run if your fees don't increase? Inflation will eat away at your viability over the long run. What do you guys plan to do about that? And he makes a very good point. And if he obviously is an advisor, if he's thinking of going to our pricing model, this is something that was expressed to me by none other than Michael Kitsis years ago when I ran this. He's not going to remember this conversation at all. I'm just a little peon. The guy talks to so many people every year. But I remember pinning him down at, I think it was the retirement income form, one of them that you didn't go to, or mm-hmm. it might have been an FPA meeting. I can't remember where it was. I think FPA meeting. And I was telling him that I was thinking of going, this is years ago, going to this type of fixed fee structure. And at the time, he was dead against it. He loves it now. But at the time, he was dead against it. And he said to me, you are not going to be able to increase your fees. What are you going to do? Charge the same price 10, 20 years into this? And it struck home. But I also, in my mind, disagreed with him. I don't think I disagreed with him to his face. I did at another time. We had a very heated discussion on topics. But it got me to thinking that I don't think people are going to have a problem, listener, paying additional fees. We adopted this pricing model as our pricing model 3 years ago. Prior to that, it was an optional pricing model. And inflation was relatively low. but it has come roaring back. And I will have to be raising my prices. We tell our clients when they come into our program, this is what we're charging today. And I haven't raised my prices in 3 years. We can't keep doing this. And we're going to have to raise our prices because, unlike the traditional AUM model that, as, remember, who is it, Fisher, when you do better, we do better?
Mm-hmm.
And you like to say, when you do better, you do better. That's our motto. Fisher says, when you do better, we do better. He means, as your portfolio grows, or in the case of retirees, you just keep consolidating more money with me, meaning Fisher's company, we're going to keep making more money. So we're doing better, and oh, by default, you're doing better. I guess that's their rationale. Of course, we take the when you do better, you do better approach. So we explain to our clients, listener, that we will have to raise prices. And my intent was to raise them every 3 to 5 years. That's what I told clients. Mm-hmm. And we will be raising prices at the end of this year, 3 years into it. We have no choice. Inflation last year was very high. It's going to be very high this year. Our costs are rising. Our labor costs rise significantly higher than traditional COLA. We have to charge more. So we will we will do our first price increase. And we'll communicate that with our clients. But the brilliance of it, Chris, it's all fully disclosed. They see it all.
Yeah, and the nice thing is when you're paying less than average, and then the growth inflation part is less than average. When I say average, the inflation on your fees with a pure AUM person means your fees are going up at the rate that your investments are going up. Maybe not on an individual year basis, but in the long haul, investments go up faster than inflation. Otherwise, there'd be no reason to invest because you would never make a return. So, that's just how it works. And they bank on that. They bank on that. That's the beauty of that funding model. Well, I'm going to get rich along with my clients because my fees are going to get, compounded growth at the rate of investment growth as we go down the road. That's not how we're not keying our growth in fees on your portfolio growing rate, which should outpace inflation. So we're going to base it not, we're not tying it directly to CPI necessarily. We're looking at it more like the inflation on our cost to provide this service. And so you're going to benefit a bit on our efficiencies as we, improve this, as we improve everything we do every single year. But there will be some inflation. But if you start out lower and you inflate lower, guess what? You're going to still be paying lower. That's the way I would describe it.
Right. It's, again, I could understand Kitsis's argument or point, and he is right. The one of the reasons, folks, the AUM model refuses to die and is going to die a very slow, slow death, if it dies at all, is it borrows from behavioral finance, and it's a concept called layering. The more layers you can put between a person and their money, the less likely it is the people are going to even remember they're paying the fee, if even question the fee. So the first thing that it can do is it's automated. It just comes out of the account right away. There's no separate invoice. We invoice separately for our financial planning. We invoice separately for our positioning. We do not invoice for our AUM. Well, we do invoice, but what I'm saying is we do take that money out of the account because from a tax perspective, it's the best thing to do when managing an IRA because our fee can be debited from your IRA tax-free. So I'm not going to send you an invoice and have you pay it with a check where you got to use after-tax money. If you're hiring us to help you manage your IRA, I'm going to debit it from your IRA. Now, legally speaking, you are not supposed to pay financial planning fees from an IRA tax-free. But when you pay for general AUM and that money's coming from an IRA and it's also providing you financial planning, technically speaking, not even technically, legally speaking, that's a prohibited transaction. Even Kitsis agrees on that. It's a prohibitive transaction. He makes the argument that one could say to the IRS, in order to manage money, one must first have a retirement plan or financial plan in place, ergo the two are interrelated. We don't take that approach. But do you have any issues with that? Before I go on, I want to make sure you understand that, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I have No issues with that.
Perfect. So when it comes time to us to go and have to raise our prices, we're not going to get that layering effect. The money is going to be directly told to the client. It's got to come out. Layering is the automatic withdrawal and the increasing of fees. Fishers, when you do better, we do better. As the account grows, Fisher's getting more money, or all the AUM guys are getting more money. It's layered. It's coming out automatically. You never see it. You're sent a quarterly invoice on your statement you probably never even read. So the money is coming out. You don't know it. You don't see it. You don't feel it. It's being increased every year as the portfolio is growing or you're contributing to it. So that's called layering. I knew going into this model, I'm going to not benefit fully from layering, if you will. I have to tell clients every year or every 3 years or 5 years, your fee is going up. And I have to explain why and be able to defend it. CPI is up this much. Our cost of labor has increased this much. We've improved efficiencies over here. So overall, we're going to have to raise your fees X amount. Where else has someone ever explain to you like that on the advisory side, Chris, why your fees are going up? I don't know. Perhaps an AUM guy who's saying, I'm no longer going to charge you 1%, I'm going to charge you 1.1, and here's why. Maybe they have to do it that way. But I did know going into this, this was allegedly presented to me as a hindrance to my approach. I don't think it's going to be, and so far it hasn't been.
Yeah.
Okay. So then we got another email from someone who pointed out something. He went and found the Morningstar, albeit an old one, he said. I don't know how old it is, but he found one of the allocation breakdowns for the target risk portfolios, that the benchmarks that Morningstar uses. Now, Morningstar has in there about 20 allocation classes, folks, and he noticed something and he wrote the following. Hi, Jim and Chris. Excellent podcast. Thank you for sharing. And he is from Massachusetts, so, and he does say he's a Patriots fan, so good for him. All right, although we lost one of our best cornerbacks yesterday, too, so we're not going to do too good this year. All right, it says, hello, Jim and Chris. Excellent podcast. Thank you for sharing. I'm really enjoying the current EDU series on the investment process. I found an older version of the Morningstar target risk allocations, and I noticed that real estate and commodities are very small across all five target risk benchmarks. They comprise between 1 and 3%, and in some portfolios, zero, and he is correct, in the conservative portfolios, there's none, no commodities. Commodities don't actually appear until you get into the more quote-unquote risky portfolios. And he is right, about 1 to 3% in commodities, Chris, and real estate. So he says, can you comment on those two asset classes and if you're comfortable with those low allocation levels? I currently put 15% of my entire net worth in real estate and 5% of my net worth in commodities. The real estate does not include my primary residence. This is a issue that I actually did talk with Travis about when we were designing these portfolios. And it's not only Travis's opinion, but mine, that right now we don't consider it to be a problem. First, at the higher level, if you will, when we chose a passive approach, you have to model some type of index or benchmark, Chris. That's the whole idea of passive. You have to find something to model, or you have to create your own allocations. And that was something we thought of. And I quickly shot that down because I don't have the research depth of these professional firms. I don't have dozens of analysts working for me, economists, people who are evaluating global economic trends, political trends. This is what these big firms have. Dozens of people on these teams all bringing their own expertise. Travis and I thought about creating our own allocations, Chris, but then we were running into the same situation. How do we measure the success of our allocations? Well, we got to find what? A benchmark to compare ourselves to. And then what is our aim? To match the benchmark or beat it? If we're going to try to beat that benchmark, now we're more active managers and we want to be passive. So if we're going to be passive managers, we don't want to beat the benchmark. We want to just track the benchmark. If we want to track it, why create our own benchmark to track something that we could track on its own? Literally, that was the conversation we had. Did that all make sense to you?
Yeah, believe it or not, yes.
I'm impressed I did that without tongue-tying at all. Let me tell you.
It's only because you didn't have to read it.
With a I have trouble reading the emails more than coming off the top of my head. With a dead spot in my head, by the way. I did that perfectly. But honestly, folks, Travis and I, had the CFA I hired, Chartered Financial Analyst, who works with us, we looked at it. That was like a catch-22. It was like, well, wait, we got to do this. But if we do that, we do this. We're right back to square one. So we said, no, we're not going to create our own. We're going to use a professional benchmark. We chose Morningstar for many, many reasons. We don't have to get into them. So to the listener who is saying, do I have a problem with these low allocation percentages? For instance, this year, yeah, I wish Morningstar had much more in commodities than they do. But commodities are also known in the industry as having lottery-like returns. Do you know what that means, Chris?
Yeah, they'll be boring, and then suddenly there'll be a splurge when something happens.
Yes, hit or miss.
Yep.
You're going to make a killing off them, or they're holding your portfolio back. Commodities are that portfolio insurance that you all hate insurance. You do it yourselfers. You don't want to buy long-term care insurance, most of you, because you think you're never going to need it. Commodities are that insurance that the cost is they underperform equities or a generally diversified portfolio most years. But when things go south a little, or you get these global political issues like we're having in Ukraine and prior to that, I mean, gas was going up and commodities were going up long before Putin invaded. They've been going up for the past year. When you have the confluence of all these issues that don't happen all the time, yes, commodities may outperform. But we didn't want, we being Travis and I, didn't want to stray from being 100% passive. We have to stick to that. So we place our faith, is what I'm saying, Chris, in the analysts at Morningstar. And if they felt comfortable, or if they felt the need of having more commodities in their portfolios or more real estate, we felt they would put them in. And as luck would have it, this morning alone, folks, Morningstar came out with a white paper on diversification. It's a very long, rambling. I only got through about the first three or four pages of what I think is a 20 or 30 page report. And they address a lot of that I can see. And they get into a lot of interesting concepts, if you will, Chris, on diversification. And so I'm going to open it up and I'm going to read a few of the things that I thought were kind of interesting. But to also point out to this listener, if you like having this percentage in commodities and real estate, you don't have to design your portfolio, your passive approach to your portfolio, our way. You can find, first of all, there's dozens and dozens of research firms who have these types of measuring benchmarks for you to use. Some will take much bigger allocations than Morningstar to commodities. So just open, if you will, not open, because you're going to try to mimic, so you're not going to open an account with them, but just try to get those allocations and design your own portfolio around that. Or if you like the Morningstar ones like we do, say to yourself, okay, but I'm going to override Morningstar and I'm going to make sure my portfolio has 5% commodities, 15% real estate, whichever way he had it broken down, 15% real estate, 5% commodities. Do it on your own. You don't have to do what we do perfectly. But here's a couple of takeaways, Chris, from that Morningstar. If somebody wants to Google it, I don't know if you can get it. This was sent to me. It said, it was titled 2022 Diversification Landscape. And it's a white paper from Morningstar. It has 37 pages. its little subtitle is A Look at How Key Asset Classes Performed in 2021, How Correlations Have Changed, and the Implications for Portfolio Building. But a couple of the takeaways, Chris, on diversification that I thought kind of stood out to me. They said over the past 20 years, correlations have edged up. And do you want to explain to our listeners what Morningstar means by correlations?
That's just simply describing how things tend to move together or separate. And if you're looking for diversification, you do not want correlation. It's actually the lack of correlation that creates the diversification. So when they make the comment that correlations are moving up, that's actually bad news for those trying to seek the benefits of diversification.
Now, what I'm about to read may explain why Morningstar analysts don't put more real estate or commodities in their target risk allocations. It is not to say they're right. It's not to say they're wrong. And it's not to say, listener, you need to get your 15% in real estate and 5% in commodities out. It's just to give you some food for thought. They said over the past 20 years, correlations have edged up for several asset classes, including commodities, corporate bonds, global bonds, high-yield bonds, REITs, and TIPS. So you saw, listener, REITs and commodities were listed in that. And Morningstar goes on to say, many of these categories have posted losses in periods of equity market stress. So they're saying they're not adding some of the diversification that you hope. I'm not saying they're right. I'm not saying they're wrong. They go on to say, and this is something that I've known for years, and you probably have known for years as well, Chris. Excuse me. You're not getting good diversification benefits from foreign stocks. They said correlation between the United States and developed markets around the world have been high, and global diversification hasn't improved portfolio performance. Anyone will know that who's been in this industry a long time. There was a time where the thought was you should own a basket of stocks from a basket of countries, because one country could blow up and the others would do fine. You don't see that much anymore. Do you agree on that, Chris?
Yeah, international correlations have increased greatly over the past 50 years. So that old wisdom is still there to a certain extent, but it's greatly diminished the benefits of global diversification.
And then they wrap up with saying diversification strategies that have worked in the past may not work in the future. That is particularly true now that the landscape is shifting for both interest rates and inflation. In a period of ongoing equity market weakness precipitated by rising yields, treasuries and other bonds might be less reliable diversifiers, although they still have merit in a portfolio holding. Why do I want to end with that? It leads right into the next question we got from someone. Do we have a chance to answer the next question?
You can do one more as long as you don't ramble too far.
Perfect. This person picked up exactly on that. So hopefully, listener who asked about those low holdings of real estate and commodities, I my answer is I'm just relying on the research of Morningstar. If anybody wants that Morningstar report, I don't mind sending it to you. If you can't Google it and find it, just fire me off an email. I'll attach the PDF to a reply and send it back to you. It literally just came out this morning. Or at least it came out March 1st, but I wasn't sent the report until this morning. So anyways, I liked that last part that Morningstar said, Chris, because it ties into this question. And this is from, we'll call him George in Virginia. I'm a longtime listener, and up until this series of shows, I would have never submitted an asset management question to your inbox because it was not a topic you guys focused on. He's right on that, is he not?
Yeah, we haven't talked about it much until this five-part series.
Yeah, we will never talk about individual investments on this show. But yes, we used to keep hush on our investment philosophy and approach. We're sharing a little bit more about it. A lot has to do with the caterpillar turning into a moth. Moth.
There's some pretty moths,
you could, too. There's some pretty moths, but our caterpillar is turning into a butterfly. That's referencing the fact that we've paused. We're not accepting new retirement planning clients. We do accept investment management clients, insurance clients, tax clients, but we have paused accepting retirement planning clients right now. And that's part of the reason we wanted to cover a little bit about our philosophy on asset management, because it ties into what our firm is going to emerge as, what Chris and I liken to be, in our opinion, the retirement planning firm of the future that's going to take care of our retirement. So anyways, we'll get into more of that next year. So it says, I'm a longtime listener, and up until this series of shows, I would have never submitted an asset management question to your inbox because it was not a topic that you guys focused on. But since you solicited questions related to your series of asset management, here you go. You often mention the classic 60-40 portfolio. I recently read a book entitled The New 60-40. Now, I have not got this book, nor have I read it. But he goes on to say, in the book, they endorsed a different kind of 60-40 portfolio. I would be interested in your evaluation of the author's idea. The author makes the case that bonds have nowhere to go but down. And I think, or what I'm getting at, Chris, if you remember on that Morningstar last paragraph, diversification strategies have worked in the past, may not in the future, and they list a bunch of assets that they asset classes that they feel may not offer diversification because of periods of ongoing equity weakness and rising yields. Treasuries and other high quality bonds might be less reliable diversifiers. So this gentleman, the premise of his book, according to this listener, goes on and says, the author makes the case that bonds have nowhere to go but down, so he suggests replacing the bond portion of your 60-40 portfolio with, and he's putting it in quotation marks, and he bolded it. So he wants to bring it to my attention, what the author is saying, with quote-unquote, unlimited upside, no fee, fixed indexed annuities. I nearly gagged when I read that.
Yeah.
He acknowledges that you will give up some liquidity. You're going to give up a lot of liquidity.
You give up some. Yeah.
He acknowledges that you will give up some liquidity, but he makes what sounds like a reasonable argument that most people will not be harmed. All right, couple of things. We already are doing something similar to what this gentleman, the author of this book, does. I didn't read the book. I didn't look up the author. My gut is going to tell me he's an insurance guy because of the way, assuming what this emailer put in quotation marks and bolded, unlimited upside, no fee, fixed indexed annuities, that's coming from an insurance guy.
Yeah.
Or gal. That's coming from the insurance side because everything in there is wrong.
It's a very simplistic, watered down,
it's a half
verging
truth.
On half misleading.
Truth. Misleading.
Yeah.
I like that.
Quote about how fixed indexed annuities actually work.
Right. So let's get into the concept, though. That we have started to do. I have sat with Travis. Even though, folks, we are passive managers using passive investments, I'm human. I don't believe in market timing. I believe in tax loss selling timing, which is something we're doing now, and we'll share when Bob gets out of hibernation from doing his tax preparation. We're going to talk about that. We time tax losses, especially in periods of high market volatility. But I have to look objectively at fixed income. I don't want to take clients out of fixed income. That's not what we're advocating. And in defense of this book, that's not what he is advocating. Because an indexed annuity, I would put in the category of fixed income, if you will. Even though the returns of a quote-unquote indexed annuity are tied to usually an equity market or an equity index, to me, they would be a good fixed, I don't want to say fixed annuity, a good fixed income or bond-like holding. So Travis and I looked at, in our typical 60-40 portfolio, Chris, we did it for all portfolios, but we looked at, okay, what are the asset classes on the fixed income side we are truly worried about if interest rates are going to rise? They're going to rise for either two reasons. The economy comes roaring back, everything is great, nothing bad in the world is going on, and it's just growing so much, it's going to pull interest rates up. The Fed can release everything that they've done to support the economy and start raising rates on that. Or rates are going to go up because of inflationary pressures. Now we seem to be having a little bit of both. You throw the invasion of Kuwait in... Kuwait.
Oh, that's a throwback.
That's a throwback. You throw the invasion of Ukraine, not Ukraine, Ukraine into the mix. The Fed's between a rock and a hard place right now. I thought for sure they were going to be doing several rate increases this year. They're still going to do one in March, they said. But they can't go too fast because if that global geopolitical thing blows up, they're in a bind. But outside of that immediacy, this author is correct, Chris. Going forward, chances are rates will rise. When rates rise, bonds do what?
The prices of bonds go down, which is what everybody's fixating on. I have to remind people there's two ways to make money on bonds, though. The price that you pay versus what you get when you sell them, that differential, but then also the interest payments that the bonds make. So I think people always forget to mention that second part. So keep that in mind as well. But the prices, absolutely. The price of an existing bond that's out there, if you own it, as interest rates go up and you wanted to go out and sell your bond then, you're going to find that the bond has gone down in value. The only time you know what you're going to get for the bond for sure is if you hold it to maturity.
Correct. Or to call date, depending on how the bond is structured.
Yeah, but you don't get to determine the call.
No, they do. But you know the call date, and generally all our clients' bonds that are callable because they're still paying rates higher than current rates are being called.
You know they're going to be called. Yeah, exactly. So that depends on the characteristics of that bond.
But, I joke with my clients, don't answer the phone. Just don't answer the phone. They call me? It's like, no.
That's pretty good.
Yes, they're
going to
call
though.
You. Don't answer the phone.
Yeah, just don't answer the phone. You got to keep it. No, you don't, everyone. You don't.
Okay, so back to what the book premise and this listener's question. We have been looking at this in our own office. Even though I'm passive approach, folks, I'm a realist. And I know interest rates are trending higher. And fixed income portion of portfolios are dropping. Most people who own, we've been looking at this for our conservative and moderately conservative. We have not proposed this yet to our moderate, moderately aggressive and aggressive clients. Why? They tend to have a higher stomach, Chris, to what?
Volatility.
Volatility and portfolio losses. But when people are in our conservative and moderately conservative, they tend to not want to see portfolios drop. We have one other type of portfolio. We didn't mention it, but we do have fully principal protected portfolios. We call it losing money safely, but we can put it in cash and cash-like holdings, multi-year guaranteed annuities, and maybe even a fixed index annuity like this person talked about. Those will give you the principal protection. So let's carry that over. If clients right now we've been looking who have a conservative, a moderately conservative portfolio, we've been chatting with them on their reviews that, hey, they've been noticing their portfolios have been dropping. Owning bonds means you have less volatility than equities. It does not mean you don't lose money. I hate when they say the bonds are the growth pot, the equities are your growth pot or your risk pot, and the bonds, they are your low risk pot. They're not. They're low volatility and high volatility. You're going to get price fluctuations in bonds up and down.
They typically are about half of what we see with equities.
Correct. You get less volatility, but they still go up and down.
Correct.
So we've been and have been for a while now identifying the clients, meeting with them and saying to them, look, you have a multitude of different types of bonds in your Morningstar target risk allocation. The bonds that are in the long-term government, intermediate, corporate, high yield, foreign, those are going to fall the most. Your short-term, ultra short-term, and cash-like holdings, we don't feel the need to take that money out. But if you are concerned with rising interest rates, and we have to first make sure what? We get a hold of Chris, or we look at Chris's, I don't want to get too deep into it, Chris takes these amazing notes. What do you call your document there? Planner notes, right? Isn't that what you call it?
I call them client case notes.
Client case notes. Mm-hmm. I can open his client case note document, which is lengthy, trust me, and read it and know pretty much everything I would have needed to know if I went in and chatted with Chris. I may still go in and say, hey, I was looking, I want to make sure I get this right. But what we do on the investment team is we have to first make sure clients can afford the illiquidity that this is going to cause to their portfolio. I don't like how he worded that you're going to have to give up, quote unquote, some liquidity. You're going to have to give up a hell of a lot of liquidity if you go into an annuity. That's just the way it is. So we have to make sure first that there is no liquidity needs or there are other ways we can get it. We do that by tying in the financial plan, looking at the spending that might be happening in the not too distant future. Once we can identify an amount of money that we feel we could put in a fixed income-like holding without the principal loss, that's the key. With interest rates that are already paying more than you're going to get on a 10-year bond, but you're only going to tie up with an insurance company for probably 2, 3, 4 years, maybe 5, depending on how much interest you want, they are a viable option. But Travis agreed with me, there's no need, Chris, to put all 40% in a 60-40 portfolio in these annuities, and I worry that's what this book might be advocating. There is no reason, because there are some bonds you want that they're designed to be liquid and move just a little. An ultra short bond, Chris, a short term bond. Keep those monies very liquid, very available in the ETF structure. But yes, put some or all of the longer term bonds if the clients don't want to see principal loss. The idea of keeping it on a low scale, a 2-year or a 3-year MYGA, multi-year guaranteed annuity. I know why the book author is recommending fixed index annuities and not MYGAs, Chris. Do you?
No.
Commissions. You make a hell of a lot more selling a fixed index annuity than your MYGA. So if you're an insurance person and you're looking to get more money, you're going to sell a fixed indexed annuity, which will commission buka bucks, as opposed to a MYGA, which will commission even less. And in the case of our firm, because if we're managing the money, which is who we do this for, we do not do this for people whose assets we don't manage. If you hire us for financial planning, a retirement plan, we will tell you how much money you to put into each pie slice. We will not tell you the investments. If we're not managing your money and doing the due diligence and tracking it, we can't do that. Chris will tell you the dollar amounts, but if you're a do-it-yourselfer, it's the very nature, you're a do-it-yourselfer, you go out and do it yourself, find the investments. If you're working with another advisor, take the information to him or her and say, hey, find the investments. With us and the way we price our models, Chris, how do we treat MYGA annuities that we are using in this protection strategy?
Well, we treat these as part of their fixed income portfolio. Yeah.
It's just another asset class.
Yeah.
We will put them in, quote unquote, fee-based or commission-free annuities that generally, not all the time, we'll look at both, will pay more, the fee-based, than the commission-based annuities, but we don't charge for them. They're just another asset class in our eyes. Whether we're putting you in a series of ETFs or a series of MYGAs, it's an asset class. We do have to charge an account opening fee a little bit higher than our traditional $50 per account. Annuities are a lot more work for us to open, so we charge $150 to open an annuity for our client or clients. But we don't charge anything else on top of that. So they can have, Chris, as this book guy is saying, the protection from rising interest rates. Why? The MYGA will pay. Right now, a 5-year MYGA that we're using for a particular company is going to pay between 3 and 3.25%, depending on how much money you put in. That is significantly higher than the 10-year bond even today. So we can put them in that. If interest rates keep rising and the 10-year goes from about 2.1 or so where it was today, if it continues to rise to 3 even, you're not going to suffer, Chris, that principal loss. Now, if the interest rates get above 3 when the MIGA matures, you don't have to renew it inside that MIGA. You can say, no, I'm going to take it, put it in another one, or by then, Chris, you might be fine with bonds again. And you'll be, okay, I'm going to take that money, I'm going to put back into bonds.
Or it might be time to use the money.
Or it might be time to use the money. Mm-hmm. So I like what the book author is saying. It's being used more, though, to sell high commissioned annuities. And I hate when I read unlimited upside, no fee. Fixed index annuities are not fee-free. They're not no fee. You don't pay a fee. I will admit that. The insurance company, though, makes their money off of the yield spread. So tell an agent who's telling you, a broker agent who's selling a commission product, this is no fee. Say, good. Can you show me what I'm going to earn buying this commission fixed indexed annuity from you to a corresponding fee-based fixed index annuity that pays you no commission? The difference between those two, Chris, is what?
That's the price.
The price.
Yeah.
That's what you're paying. So when you read no fee, I think that's hokey. Now, do keep in mind, to buy that no fee, no commission annuity, you've got to pay someone. So be very careful. We're going to read another email on a future show of someone who's paying 1% for the privilege of owning one of those annuities. At that point, the insurance guy is probably screaming, my annuity's cheaper.
Yeah.
And he's probably right.
Yeah.
So again, be very careful if you're going to use annuities. Don't believe no fee. There is a fee. Someone is going to be paid. We, if we're going to make a commission, we'll show you why we think the commission one is better. We'll even tell you, I have to call the company because I have no idea what I earn on these. They're between 0.5% and 1.5% on a MIGA. I have no idea what I'm going to get, but I can figure it out and tell you. And by the way, this is how much we're going to get, but you're going to get more money from this than the no fee one. That doesn't happen often, but sometimes it does. The majority of the time, the no fee one is paying more. And again, in our business model, it's just another asset class if we're managing money. We don't charge for it, short of the $150 we have to charge to actually open the account. So you can find, if listener, read his book, get the concepts, be very careful about going anywhere and buying an annuity, especially a quote-unquote no-fee fixed indexed annuity. Look at MIGAs. They pay the insurance agent a hell of a lot less. They may not like them, but look at them. Try to find a broker or an advisor. You have to go to an advisory channel, an RIA, registered investment advisory firm, see if they will offer you a quote-unquote no-commission MIGA or fixed index annuity, and then ask them, how much will you charge me to buy this for me? So do that kind of research. One other thing, you're not going to have all your money in one account anymore. That is a downside to this. There are some aggregators who are trying to be able to work on the with insurance companies and pull everything together, but there is no custodian, Chris, that is going to allow you to buy an annuity through them right now and see everything on one account. You can aggregate, you can get them on a platform, but they're not held at TD or Schwab or Vanguard. Keep that in mind. And then the final thing as I wrap up this, unlimited upside fixed indexed annuities, scam. No, I don't want to say scam.
It's technically not limited, so unlimited, again, it's misleading. It's not an outright
what they mean.
Lie.
Right. But what they mean by that is on a fixed indexed annuity, they're going to index the interest tie the interest they pay you to some type of index. Traditionally speaking, it's always been the S&P, or that was the standard index for years and years. To battle competition, they wanted to come with a unlimited upside, a no cap. In a traditional fixed index annuity, they're going to say, we're going to give you a 3%, 4%, 5%, 6% cap to the S&P. So if the market is up 2 and you have a 5% cap, you get 2. But if the market's up 15 and you have a 5% cap, you get 5. To me, it's no big deal. It's a fixed income, low, no volatility, safe holding. It shouldn't matter if the market is up 20. That's not what you're doing. You want an investment, go in the market. Don't buy an annuity. However, to compete against each other, Chris, they want it to be, insurance companies wanted to be able to say uncapped or unlimited, as this author put it. So what did they do? They went to Wall Street, and Wall Street created custom benchmarks for them. Most of the custom benchmarks are algorithm-driven, and they give the Wall Street firm that's designed them carte blanche to move in and out instantly, fixed income, cash, bonds. Just move out, and in periods of high volatility, the portfolios will move nearly to all cash. So the reason it's low risk bonds. So the reason it's uncapped, Chris, it's not designed to. They're not going to cap it directly by saying there's a 5% cap or a 3% cap. They're going to cap it behind the scenes because the Wall Street firm is saying, oh heck, things are looking pretty bad. Let's go to all cash. So yeah, it might be unlimited, but you might not get that great of a return. Now that said, there are some times the Wall Street, everything falls into place perfectly, Chris. There's no geopolitical issues. There's no rampant inflation. Everything is smooth. Volatility is moderate. And I have seen some of these no-capped or unique indexes, if you will, return very good amounts. 6, 8, 9%. I've been impressed. But if you look at them throughout the term you're holding them, it still averages to a much, much lower return. And the final thing, the SEC, which does not regulate annuities, has expressed concern, though, on these unique indexes. They risk controlled is sometimes how the industry refers to them. They're very opaque. They're hard to follow. You don't know what it is. And the insurance regulators, which is 50 because each state regulates insurance, but their national organization is starting to take a look at it too, saying it's a little misleading, as you say, Chris, to say it's uncapped when the index it's tied to is designed purposefully to control volatility and move people to low risk cash or something similar to that. So it's a little misleading.
Yeah, I think more than a little.
Yeah, but overall, and I think you would agree, it's a sound strategy. You know interest rates are going to rise. You don't need to keep all your bond money in bonds. You don't. And we don't. Except for the moderate, mildly aggressive, and aggressive. We haven't made that discussion yet with those people. But the people who have been reviewing their portfolios, who are conservative or moderately conservative, we are giving them this option. It, to me, makes sense. It's kind of a timeout. We encourage people to do 3-year MIGAs, not 5, even though the interest rates can be about 30, 40 basis points more. I like tying your money up for a lower amount of time. We use the fee-based as often as we can. And it's a good way, Chris, of getting yields. Right now, a 3-year is going to give you yields of about 2.6, 2.7 to get a reasonable yield for 3 years with no principal risk whatsoever as this whole issue with rampant inflation works its way out of the economy, hopefully. That's it.
That's it. So we do have a few more questions we're going to have to get to next time regarding our asset management series. So we'll probably get those done. I don't think it makes sense to start something new until we've closed the loop on a few of these loose ends. So next week we'll be doing that. This coming Q&A show will be a whole bunch of different topics. If you're ready for something different, make sure you listen into those. If you have a question for this, you've got one more week to send in a question related to asset management, but the door is always open for you to send us questions for the Q&A show. So to send questions of any kind, send them to jim@jimhelps.com, or go to our website, jimhelps.com, and you can fill in the contact form there. Either one of those will get the information to us as appropriate. I would just recommend you make it clear in the subject line of the email, if you're emailing Jim, that it is a question for the podcast. Makes it a little bit easier for him to file those away in the appropriate spot. So thanks for joining me again, Jim, and we'll be back with everyone else next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.